You're listening to Grace Saves All, the podcast which exists at the spiritual intersection of Christianity and universal salvation. In this podcast, we will be exploring an ancient and modern approach to Christianity, which affirms both that grace saves alone and that grace goes to all. And now, here is David Artman, author of Grace Saves All, The Necessity of Christian Universalism.
Today, we welcome back to the podcast Brad Jerzak. And Brad, I want to begin today with a rather involved, elaborate question that kind of puts everything on the table all at once. And then we'll just start to gradually unpack it and see where it goes. So when I was thinking of you, I thought of a person who grows up in an evangelical turn or burn kind of environment, and then moves on to the Mennonite camp and experiences the Peace Church, focusing on the nonviolent way of Jesus, and then moving on to the Eastern Orthodox Church because of its ancient repository of a more beautiful faith, which is mostly forgotten in the Western Church. Well, then the Russian Orthodox Church basically capitulates to Putin's strong fascist authoritarianism and blesses the war in Ukraine. And now evangelicals in the U.S. have capitulated to what I'll call fascism in its training wheel phase with Trump, in which we are basically busy being the world's greatest victim and sticking it to places like Canada, who've been ripping us off all these years. Meanwhile, Gaza's being basically wiped off the face of the map in response to a horrible terrorist attack. But is the correct response to a terrorist attack genocide? So, Brad, how do we navigate correctly in this increasingly authoritarian, fascist-leaning world and still be true to Jesus? And on top of that, still try and hold on to our belief in a perfectly good God whose ultimate plan is the universal restoration of all creation?
Well, that's a loaded series of questions, isn't it? I would say I agree with most of the premises, you know, like, it's strong language, but these are the days for that. I'm not sure where to start. Do you have a sense of which phrase you want to start with? Which part of that would be a good?
Well, I wanted to pay. I wanted to kind of try to get into maybe how you're experiencing this from your background, because you do have backgrounds in these areas that I think have been that have been really affected by an authoritarianism. So you have a background in evangelicalism and even in the Mennonite camp, that's a peace church, but there's also very conservative kind of social moral norms and ideas in the Mennonite group. So they're a peace church, but they're also kind of, I would call them culturally conservative. And then you're in the Eastern Orthodox Church, which has this memory of this older, more beautiful faith, but also has the same kind of cultural conservatism that is present there. And so in all of these movements, that cultural conservatism has kind of been weaponized by authoritarian movements. It varies around the world. And I was just wondering, you know, how this affects you. Plus, you're in Canada, right?
Yeah.
So I thought, what an interesting perspective, just to hear kind of how all this is hitting you based upon your background.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And so I can move through some of those because they're very poignant. So for example, first 22 years of my life, I was in a conservative evangelical church that also had that sort of assumption of Zionism, mm-hmm. and that the land of Israel belongs to the Jews, and we were dispensationalists who looked forward to and maybe even incited Armageddon, you know, and we didn't realize how incredibly anti-Semitic our Zionism was. And I've come to really see that through people like Mark Braverman, for example, who is a Jesus-following non-Christian mm-hmm. Jew, who is also the head of Kairos USA, which is a pro-Palestinian advocacy group. So this is a Jew telling us that our Christian Zionism that I grew up with not only is destructive and it's behind the genocide right now in Gaza, but it's also intrinsically anti-Semitic because it replaces faith in Christ, faith in Abraham, the God of Abraham, that faith, it replaces faith with a secular state. Well, it's trying to become a nationalist state, but what it certainly is bizarre about it is that that Christian Zionist take on it is, you know, the Jews will be destroyed. So it's horrendous. And so I grew up with that. And it was partly my move to the Mennonites that opened my eyes to it, because the Mennonites were over there in the West Bank building elementary schools for Muslim and Christian children. Mm-hmm. And they would experience the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, would come by with bulldozers and bulldoze these elementary schools built and funded by Mennonites while evangelicals were cheering. I mean, it blew my mind and it sort of wrecked my worldview. This is what happened to Mark Braverman as well. He goes over there as a Zionist conservative Jew. He sees the mistreatment of the Palestinians and he lost his faith. And it was only through following Jesus that he became the Jew he always hoped he would be. So that evangelical foundation really got the wind knocked out of it for me. So that's that phase of it. And then you mentioned the Mennonites. You know, it was really marrying into that clan and then being a pastor in their church for 10 years that I discovered the nonviolent way of Jesus. And I should just back up. The evangelical group I was with were Baptists. Mm-hmm. I want to say a side note about that, because you're going to hear a minority report all the way through. So the minority report inside of that evangelical Zionist Christian nationalism was my uncle, who was my great uncle, who was a Baptist pastor in Czechoslovakia, tortured by authoritarian regimes for his faith. So there was also this resistance that looked like faithfulness and an experience of torture and ultimately martyrdom at the hands of authoritarians. So we have a nose for it. Mm-hmm. Similarly, when I went to the Mennonites, I worked for 6 years with a guy named Peter Bartel. He was a real mentor to me in the Jesus way. And, you know, he was seeing how Mennonites were becoming more and more hoodwinked by sort of that cult, what you called cultural conservative, leaning further and further right all the time. And he goes, hang on a second, Brad, don't be duped by this. I remember this from Germany. And so Peter Bartel, he remembers as a little boy all this same rhetoric under Hitler. And he even experienced this idea that, you know, that the Mennonites, who'd always been peace lovers and had experienced authoritarian regimes in Russia, where my wife's grandfather was taken and killed by Stalin. So now they're down in Germany and they don't like the Stalinists, but Hitler saved their farms from the banks and those horrible corrupt bankers who were going to, they were going to foreclose on their farms. Well, guess what? A corrupt banker is, that's a placeholder for Jews. You know, that's mm-hmm. how they saw it. So they kind of owed Hitler. They did. And they actually turned a blind eye to a death camp 14 kilometers away. But minority report, Peter Bartel's grandfather resists. He's put, thankfully, not in a camp, but he's under house arrest. And he begins to write commentaries on the Old Testament prophets and how Daniel was speaking to this exact thing. These are beasts, and the people of God need to stop selling out, and they need to be faithful in the face of the kind of nationalism they were looking at. Well, now fast forward to me now, and you know, for the last, I started my catechism in the Orthodox Church in 2003, but I only joined under, you know, I was kind of dragged in. In some ways by the beautiful theology and the early church kind of doctrines, sort of like apokatastasis, the restoration of all things. And so I became a member, 13 years ago through chrismation, but it's exactly what you said now. We've got Putin has, in Russia, and he's co-opted the church there. So the patriarch, he's really not he's an oligarch, Kirill. And you know, the Pope warned him, do not become Putin's altar boy. And he absolutely has. Or maybe Putin's his altar boy, but he's absolutely into sort of this Russian nationalism and their destiny, and pre-blessing the invasion of Ukraine as if it's faithfulness to Jesus Christ. And that's just blasphemy, and it's antichrist. And now it's come closer to home in the last couple of weeks, where, you know, usually the Greek Orthodox Church will pray a prayer of blessing for any president, Democrat or Republican, when they come into power. But I think it's maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago now. It depends when you air this too. But so the Greek Orthodox Archbishop in America had Trump by his side, and he said to President Trump, you are the embodiment of the love and faithfulness of Jesus. And you remind me of the Emperor Constantine. And he gives Donald Trump a gold cross, and he says, and remember what Jesus said to Constantine at his conversion, in this sign conquer, you know. And I'm watching this, and I have to say, my first thoughts were, I'm out. And a lot of other, you know, I've always known there's been this Achilles heel of nationalism in the Orthodox Church. But as a Canadian, you know, in a little congregation, a parish of, really doesn't have a lot to do with us. We don't bow the knee to Kirill or to the Greeks in America. But no, this is just, it's endemic to Orthodoxy. And I have to say, I have distanced from that. I am more Anabaptist in my bones about this stuff, and it is so ungodly. And so what I'm being reminded of by other Orthodox is, like, it's always been like this. It's a there's a minority report that is prophetic. And I'm like, well, then where are they? And they better speak up. And, you know, so I'm trying to be one. I know Sister Vasa, a wonderful nun from Vienna, she's been speaking up. Father John Baer has been quite clear about that, you know, but this is an exception, you know? And so in every time I find myself in a church community, I am faced with the challenge of Christian nationalism and the temptation to get in bed with the beast. And we just keep doing it again and again in more and more overt ways. And it's and the last thing I'll just say there, you know, speaking as a Canadian, we do tend to be a vassal state of the American Empire, and I welcome the tension right now. I'm not able to cross the border right now, just because I could probably get away with it. But if I don't, it's catastrophic, because I've been public about my support of the Palestinian people, which Marco Rubio says, well, then we know where you stand now. And so,
you would be qualified as an anti-Semite.
Yeah, yeah. Despite the fact that our school, St. Stephen's University, it has just hosted a conference resisting anti-Semitism. But like I said before, Mark Braverman was the keynote speaker, and he's helping us to see that the Jewish prophetic tradition has always been about concern for the vulnerable, welcome of the stranger, and resistance to participating in imperial treaties. You know, the Old Testament's clear about Israel's relationship to the land. The relationship to land is dependent on two things: that you treat the strangers with justice, and that you never enter a military treaty with a foreign empire. Well, hello. So this is, I'm watching this, and I'm like, I don't know, even know what's good or bad right now, because I'm probably watching the beginning of the end of America, the American as an empire, and that's probably good. But when these things start flailing, there's a lot of collateral damage. It's very, very, there's a death count, a body count on it. So that's my raw, you asked raw questions. That's my raw answers.
Yeah. And I don't really have good answers to it. I'm not exactly sure how I'm navigating through this is correct. I'm not sure if I'm saying enough or if I'm being public enough. I did feel like this is a moment to not be silent.
Yeah.
And my podcast up until this point has really veered away from any kind of political conversation or even conversation about issues kind of outside of the hope of an ultimate redemption or universal restoration. But then now this has happened, and I feel like this is a point at which if I'm silent, I'm somehow complicit in whatever I am. I don't want to be complicit. And here's how it felt in my soul. When fascism came knocking on the door, did you remain silent?
Right.
And I really want the answer to that question to be no, that at least I did say something. And you used an interesting word, and this word resonates with me. You talked about the beast.
Yep.
And there's something about naming the beast for me, at least. And when I was able to say, I think that what we're dealing with, not just in the United States, but in the world, is just a rising tide of fascism. Fascism is a particular kind of authoritarianism. Fascism imagines a kind of mythic past, and it creates a culture of victimhood. And, you know, there's many characteristics to how fascism works. But one of the things that it does is in appealing to the culture, the root culture, and fascism doesn't really matter what religion it's working with. Fascism will weaponize any religion. But in the sense of what's happening with Christianity, it's appealing to that sort of the conservative idea that we need to restore the home and the family, and the man needs to be the center of the household. We need to restore order in society, that things have gotten chaotic, in order to save things, we need to pull together under one leader, and there cannot be any. There's no legitimate opposition. Anybody that resists is a crazy left wing Marxist, and who is an enemy of the state. And it creates kind of this bunker mentality, and we're being invaded, and these people are coming, and they're poisoning our blood, and so these immigrants have to be vanished. Even the ones that are here, they say, okay, it's the ones that are here legally that are committing the crimes. But then also it just seems that there was talk, well, they all just need to go. We just need to purify this. We need to get this, our country purified again. And whether this happens in Russia or the United States or in other places in the world, it's a kind of an old playbook. But for me, at least just being able to say, okay, what we have here is a case of fascism. This is that somehow naming the beast and being able to say what it is, that is something that can be done. And so that people who might be involved with it might say, wait a second, am I involved in that? Is that really, do I really want to hook my wagon to, I might have some resonance with some of the concerns here but do I really want to be a part of this? Do I really want to be a part of this thing? And so, I'm just trying to do what I can do to help people who might be kind of on the fence about this. And they're just wondering, like, you know, they're seeing some of the things that are going on. They're saying, is this good? Should I be a part of this? And I just want to do something to say, well, no, I don't think that you should be. These are dangerous authoritarian movements. And even though they might be offering you some things that you're sympathetic to, the downside of them is far worse than the things that they are promising you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you, David. And, you know, and in that sense, it's not just left versus right, progressive versus conservative, or in the America, Democrat versus Republican. This is on another register. And so I understand some of the The impulse, you know, I'm a strange bird. In Canada, we have a thing called Red Tories, and it is a kind of left-wing conservative, which makes no sense to most Americans. But it's rooted in Great Britain and came to Canada as a kind of political and social movement that was both progressive socially and conservative fiscally, all of that stuff, right? So I'm, you know, I get it when people lean left or right. I get it when people lean Democrat or Republican. I get it when people want to be progressive or conservative or both. This is something else. Then when you're naming it as fascism, here's a great tragedy that we've said, well, there's no ovens yet, as if we've got to wait till Hitler's 39 and not see Hitler's 1933. You know, these things, we're well past 33 now when people are being taken off the streets who actually were legal immigrants and being disappeared. You know, this is, that would be an example that, you know, and so of course you and I would be in great trouble for naming that probably, but I think I can connect it to never mind Hitler in the 30s. Okay, some will never buy that, but I could say this: Daniel has spoken to this, the book of Daniel. So bear in mind this. I want to read you up one paragraph from Jakob Kraker, the Mennonite minister under house arrest during Hitler's regime, and it's a call to faithfulness and also a call to hope that God is up to something right in the midst of the darkness. He said this: Israel, now Daniel's talking about under Israel when Nebuchadnezzar takes Judea into bondage, but he's writing it as somebody under house arrest with Hitler. Israel only perished in the judgment of the world when the Lord gave it into the hands of the world. Only when the Lord overturned the lampstand of the apostolic communities of Asia Minor did they lose their existence and their previous prophetic significance for the further development of history. The Lord hands over to the world only that which belongs to the world. Only when Jerusalem and the Church of Christ have once again become worldly in their essence and in their service will they be handed over to the world for judgment. If they first wed themselves with the spirit of the world, if they first strive for its goals and first operate with its means of power to secure their existence and fulfill their mission, then neither tradition nor name will protect them from perishing with the world, whether Jerusalem or the church. Then they experience the terrible truth in all its gravity that God always allows the flesh to judge by flesh. What once became flesh again in Israel, and since then also in the community of Christ, was also handed over to the flesh in its maturity and with its fruit, and shared the catastrophes of the flesh. These catastrophes then come, on the one hand, quite unexpectedly, but on the other, they're closely connected with the whole development of history. And he's talking about the various beasts there. And I'll just share one other thing here. He says, but it was God's purposeful and saving work in world events that the beast has repeatedly received its mortal wound from the beast. Had it not been for this God-given rejection of man's development of power, world history would have long since achieved in its anti-divine development the desired goal of a universal monarchy separated from God. In doing so, however, it would have also met its final judgment. However, God's hidden workings decreed that so far, no Nimrod has been able to create a lasting world monarchy. Every apparent attempt barely outlived its founder. And so then he says, and this is why the church cannot be a ministry of propaganda. It has one ministry, and that is the ministry of reconciliation. And it, in that sense, needs to be a prophet and not pander to these kind of empires. So that's quite a bit from Kraker there, but you can see what he's doing. He's like, we're watching things unravel, And there is a judgment, but it's not God as punisher. It's him handing us over to the consequences of our own defiance. But he outlives that. He outlasts that. And so does the church if we don't buy in. So that's maybe some inspiration from someone who knew what he was talking about.
Well, I know that we're talking about naming the beast. And yeah. I want to insist that we do use the F word, the fascism word.
Yeah.
And some people are concerned that the word fascism is not really well understood. It just ends up coming across as kind of a general insult.
Yeah.
But I think I want to argue that we hold on to the word to describe what we are seeing today, precisely because one of the projects of fascism is to ultimately steal even our language, particularly the word fascism itself, as it deconstructs all truth in its grab for power. So I think I would just like to say that when I say that I think fascism is an accurate description of what we're dealing with, that I'm not alone. The one of the greatest scholars on fascism, Robert Paxton, has written that Trump's incitement of the invasion of the Capitol on January 6, 2020, removes my objection to the fascist label. And then other scholars such as Timothy Snyder, author of On Tyranny, and Jason Stanley, author of How Fascism Works, agree with Paxton that what we're now seeing under Trump is best described as fascism. Donald Trump's longest-serving chief of staff, John Kelly, described his former boss as a fascist, and General Mark Milley, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that Trump is fascist to the core and the most dangerous person to this country. So it's not like I feel like I'm going out on a limb using this word. If you investigate what fascism is and how it talks about a return to a mythic past and how it all works, it's apparent to see that that's what we're dealing with. But that fascism in and of itself is still incredibly powerful because it's so appealing to many of the conservative impulses that run through the Orthodox Church or the Evangelical Church, and I'd even say through the Christian Universalist community, because or the ultimate redemption community. Because one thing I have argued is that the community of Christians that believes in ultimate redemption or universal salvation or universal reconciliation tends to be on the more culturally conservative side. Mm-hmm. I've experienced this.
Yeah.
And so I am one of my arguments has been that adopting a Christian universalist or ultimate redemption position doesn't necessarily make you a liberal. As a matter of fact, there are many quite conservative people who adopt a universal reconciliation position. And so I have some pretty good proof of this now that it's a pretty conservative group that is interested in universal reconciliation, because in my experience, I'd say more than half the people that I have met who are interested in universal reconciliation are also on board in general with what's happening with Trump and are on that side of, on that side of things. So this has divided the universal reconciliation group, at least from my perspective, just as I've experienced. Some of us seem to just be horrified. And others of us are, well, what's the big deal? I mean, we need to get things fixed, and we can't let the world go sliding off into the abyss. And it's just, it's interesting and very frustrating how this moment seems to have almost sort of cut down the middle of this community of universal reconciliation that I had seen as kind of a bridge between the best of the more conservative world and the best of the more little more progressive Christian world. I'd seen this as the place of where we're all coming together, and now this moment seems to just be cracking that apart.
Yeah, I think you're right. Sadly, it's a little bit weird to me, especially in the sense that where we saw sometimes where the Christian universalism was potentially splitting marriages apart, where somebody would feel like they've heard this liberating message, but their spouse would forbid them to believe it. And if you believe it, I'm leaving and taking the kids. And I'm like, what? This is just such great news. And then finally these, let's say these couples come together, they both agree on the best news ever. And then this political moment begins to split them up, you know? And I saw this when I visited Haiti when it was under a military regime, and the people said, "Oh yeah, the scriptures are about now. A brother will betray brother, you know, and your neighbor will call ICE on you, and these kind of things." And so, in some ways, I feel like a contemplative exercise has been very good for me. And it was to ask myself, where is Satan, whatever Satan is, you know, we won't get into an ontology or non-ontology of Satan, but as at least a representative word, right? What is Satan tempting me to despair of? And what is Jesus inviting me to despair of? So I feel like the enemy's temptation is that we would go into despondency and paralysis and silence and just acquiesce as fascism is rolling over us, and to just get with the program. And even if you don't, like, kind of just go into hiding. And that's a temptation, and it's a real temptation to despair that my children and my grandchildren, I for their sake, I just can't do that. In fact, someone from the far, far left had told me that their goal in life was to create a world in which my grandchildren will be embarrassed of me. This was somebody from the far left. And I'm like, yeah, that could happen, except it's not the far left right now that's making it. It would be fascism and my fear of it. So that's the temptation to despair, but there's also an invitation, and that is the invitation from Jesus, I think, is to despair of worldly means of overcoming this. Like, people were devastated when they lost the election, and I'm like, yes, vote, but if you're putting all your eggs in that basket, you realize your vote has about as much power as a lottery ticket. So that can't be where your hope finally is in getting one party out and another party in. And as much as we'd like to, is that the means by which Christ will save this? So I almost feel like he's invited me into saying, how do we live faithfully when it's too late? How do you live faithfully when I can't dislodge fascism politically? And even when I can't rescue the church from it anymore, because it's now, you know, at least the evangelical and some of the trad Catholics and the Orthodox, they've bought in, and I can't seem to budge them. And he's like, well, then let go of that.
Yeah, okay, I come from more of the mainline Protestant side of things, and over half of mainline Protestantism, I would say, is being affected by this as well.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, then it won't be.
I mean, if you just look, you know, the people that are just in the pews.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, of a regular, like, Methodist church or something like that, there's going to be a division there.
Yeah. And it's a major one. So if I can just let go of sort of the Messiah complex that I'm going to fix the government through political means or fix the church through however, you know, then I can maybe get past that to move on to what is it for me to be faithful in this world? And that might be different for different people. Like, you might not have had to speak up on your podcast, but you felt a conviction in your heart that this is the right thing to do right now, and you must, or you're complicit. And so I really honor that. And I'm realizing I have very, very little influence through podcasts. So I'm not thinking what I say today will fix stuff, but I felt a conviction in my heart that I had to say yes to you, and that at least go on record for myself and my conscience and with regard to faithfulness to Christ, that there is a parallel here to the boys in the fiery furnace. And gratefully, the Christian Universalist or Ultimate Redemption reading of that is a beautiful metaphor for what gets purified. What gets burnt away is the ropes and the chains and the but that we're not consumed. I'm wondering if that's also then a part of this story, to stand and speak and to be firm in the face of fascism, even when we're the Minority Report. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the holding on to that hope of an ultimate reconciliation and an ultimate redemption, because that could be one thing that could happen, is you could just get depressed about the state of the world, and the hope of an ultimate redemption might make a little more sense when it seems like we're in times where communication is getting better and we seem to be moving in a good direction. And so it seems that we are moving towards a greater commonwealth. And but when the world seems to be moving a different way from that, well, then it seems harder to hold on to this. And I have just sort of comforted myself to remember that one of the great early Christian scholars that had a universal redemption viewpoint was Origen of Alexandria, and his father was martyred, and he lived in a time when being martyred was a real threat if you were a Christian, and ultimately he was tortured at the end of his life, and he died from those wounds that he received. But during the middle of during all of that time, he developed and then held on to a theology in which he ultimately believed that the entire creation would rise, and there would be a great restoration of all things, and that there would be a reconciliation among all people, and that we would, that ultimately the end of this story is the restored creation in which we are all experiencing what in the Orthodox Church they would call theosis, union with God. So it's this extraordinarily glorious sort of ending to the story. And I don't know, help us to remember that was the story that has been remembered in dark times, and what that story is and how that helps us live through these times.
Yes, I think a great opportunity is if we would catch hold of the revelation that authoritarian rule always comes from people who think it's very utopian. If our side can take over, we can restore the world without Jesus, or with Jesus, but only a thin veneer of as a marketing tool, not the actual Jesus who calls us to turn to break down our swords into plowshares and our spears into pruning hooks, and not even train for war anymore. We don't want the actual Jesus who fulfills that. But so whether it was Stalin's kind of authoritarianism, Hitler's authoritarianism, Mao, but also in the West, what's happening right now, even that Christian nationalism actually is a utopian movement that thinks it can make the world into sort of the kingdom of God or the Third Reich or whatever through worldly means. And so that's very tempting until you see it isn't working. And then you realize the restoration of all things is not through us kind of fixing stuff up through some kind of political theory. It's through a death and resurrection. And so G.K. Chesterton, I think, said something like this, even about the church. The reason the church persists is not because it's resilient. It's because it dies and rises again over and over and over. And so I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, if Jesus can bring us to despair of political solutions, if Jesus can bring us to despair that the church will somehow make this happen through self-will, if we can see that our only hope is actually Jesus, then then there we're finally getting close to something. And I don't think we get that during peaceful times very often. We forget, you know, but when it gets really so dark that you think, you know, maybe if we try this one more thing, it'll work. And then like, it doesn't. And you're like, now what? Now we put our hope in Jesus and the resurrection and the restoration and the reconciliation of all things that only he can bring about. And of course we want to participate in. And so really, I suppose you and I aren't proposing so many solutions as to say, well, we tried that. Now, can we get back to Jesus? Who's interested? Who wants to be part of that? Because he's the one who's going to restore all things. And I want to be on that page as he does. So,
and I imagine in the restoration of all things, and I think right now we're experiencing just how difficult it is to even know, well, what is the truth? And we're in these different information worlds, and we're having trouble communicating with each other. And I've just imagine that we live in this future time in which we will know the truth. We won't just know the truth about God, but we'll know the truth about what happened.
Yeah.
We'll be able to look back profitably on what we experience as a human family, and we'll be able to see, okay, that wasn't good. You know, this is so in a way where we're kind of we learn things individually as human beings in our own experience, but we're also learning collectively as a humanity. And I'm just thinking that if we're all to come together in one body, that part of it will be able to, in a way, all look back together over what we've been through and to be able to separate the good from the bad and to know what actually did happen. And to be able to actually learn the lessons and to learn those lessons from it.
Yeah. I think, you know, ultimately Jesus will do that for us. I think until he does, we have some decisions to make about it. And so here's a little bit of contrast for you. You know, the biblicists really defended slavery in America in the mid-1800s. And they brought their Bibles and they, you know, they were really into it. But, you know, in general, now looking back, let's see, 175 years, most of us actually believe slavery was wrong. Now we can see what happened. Unfortunately, right now there's an overt movement to erase history. And so even I saw this week one of the history communiques online that used to say that the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation, all that brought an end to slavery. They erased the word slavery and they've just replaced it. That it was a great civil rights movement. And it's like, what are you doing? And so we dare not erase history. And that's quite a thing right now, probably out of shame. So what I saw in the 20th century is this. After the Holocaust, Germany was so ashamed of what had happened that a hiking partner of mine who grew up in the 50s, they couldn't learn the history of what had happened in the 50s. It was too close and it was too painful. So their immediate history was erased. But eventually, Germany came to grips with what they'd done. Not so with Russia. So while thousands of people were prosecuted for Nazi war crimes in Germany by Germany after the war, virtually none were in Russia after Stalin. And that's why Germany and Russia are acting very differently right now. Germany has been honest about their past. They've looked at it and they know what happened. Russia doesn't even know, and so they're able to repeat the same thing. And so that's a good warning for us right now. Are we gonna, until Jesus shows us all what actually happened, are we going to look at what actually happened? Are we going to resist looking at the painful parts of our past so that Jesus can redeem it and forgive us and show us mercy? Because the unwashed shame sure gets projected outward onto other people and can perpetuates injustice.
Yeah, there's a movement now towards what's being called patriotic education. And that is to then removes students' awareness of, I'll just say, the unfortunate parts of our, you know, of our history. But what that does is it makes us more prone to repeat those, and then it makes us live in a kind of denial.
Yes,
but that's
what's fascism. Absolutely, you know. So for people who wonder if we've overdone it by using the F word there, I would you mentioned some good books earlier, and I think that'd be good to have them in the show notes or something for people. And I'll just mention some. There was one called, maybe you said it, How Fascism Works.
Yeah, by Jason Stanley. Jason Stanley.
Yeah. And then you just go, here's how it works. If the shoe fits, wear it. And then, but you know, the other thing was that I had, during his first campaign, President Trump had said that he has Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, by his bedstand. And I'm like, well, then I better read it. And I've read that book twice, and where the shoe fits, wear it, because this is laying out a vision, and parts of that vision are foreign and parts of it are very, very familiar. I was gonna say, you know, you could also read The Doctrine of Fascism by Mussolini, but it's just so philosophical and boring that I don't know if you could get through it. At least with Hitler's, it has really boring, convoluted parts, and then other parts where you're just like, okay, you can see what we're doing in this book. And so, yeah, for those who don't see fascism happening right now, then we better educate.
Well, I was talking with a physician, and they said that if you have, if something's happening to you and you don't like it, you just experience it as an emotion. And that's about all that you can do with it. But once you learn to name it and you understand what it is, then you can move it into the reasoning part of your brain, and you can begin to process it. And you can begin to understand it. And so I really benefited from Jason Stanley's How Fascism Works. He has 10 characteristics in there. And when he lays all of that out, it was like getting a new set of glasses to look. When I put those glasses on, it just had so much explanatory power. And but I think it is helpful to name the beast, because people say, well, what can we do? What can we do in the midst of all of this? Well, one thing we can do is we can name the beast.
Yeah.
And to say we're not just dealing with politics, Republican, in the United States, at least Republican, Democrat politics, like we used to be dealing with. And now we're dealing with a rising tide of fascism, which threatens the whole liberal democratic process by which we used to have our debates. When I was growing up, the people talked about my esteemed colleague across the aisle.
Yeah.
You know, and that was, and we understood that we had real disagreements and real differences, but that we were still on the same page as far as moving forward with the norms of government, with democracy, with how our process works, with the checks and balances and all those things.
Yep.
Now, all of that is being threatened.
It's being deliberately dismantled by unelected appointed officials using executive orders. That's not the liberal democratic way. You know, so I was trying to explain this to a friend of mine who he's a black libertarian in America. And I'm like, he's dismantling democracy. And this guy used the F word, the four letter F word, F democracy. I mean, he was so full of grievance that he's ready to toss it. I'm like, how are you as a member of the black community buying into this? This is really weird. But to demonstrate the contrast that you've just drawn, I think if we can remember how it once was, where after they had both retired from the presidency or been removed, I guess, George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton did a tour together all around the world, demonstrating their collegiality and their shared vision, particularly about the importance of people across the aisle working together. And then even more recently, you just look at the warmth that you see between George Bush Jr. and Michelle Obama. And you watch them together and you're like, there's a kind of civility to that. And and there's an assault on that civility right now that's pretty brutal. I remember when Teddy Kennedy died at his funeral, one of his chief political opponents just shared about their friendship and about how they worked together and how they fought together and how they, we're coming towards the end of that, it seems. So then how shall we then live? Right. But at least to name it as a beast. And that, I think what Daniel's point in the book of Revelation, when they call it a beast, they are saying there's a spiritual reality, or component or factor to this, where people who of good faith are having their eyes glazed over. So I don't know, maybe if we keep just speaking the truth, some people will find that the Lord's willing to wash their eyes so they can see again. But I mean, I know some of the sweetest people, honestly, and who've been hoodwinked. I'm not sure how it works in the States, but there's got to be also a way to look outside of your echo chamber, because the two movement, let's say, they're watching different news from each other. Like they're looking through their TV screen at two complete different constructs, right? And so maybe to read more broadly and outside the U.S. You can look up what are they saying in Al Jazeera? What are they saying in The Guardian in Britain? What are they saying in the Globe and Mail in Canada? What are they, you know, Haaretz, the most important newspaper probably in Israel. So these are ways of getting out of your echo chamber, including for me, you know, but it's very hard to watch a propaganda news, and there is that too.
Well, I want to thank you, Brad, for spending some of your time with me and helping me to not be silent,
yeah,
in this moment and to name the beast. And you know, this isn't an attack on conservatism. I appreciate that in my Christian universalism, I'd run into people that were more on the conservative side of things, and I appreciated those discussions and was willing willing to have those. And so in the same way, I'm not wanting the end of a more conservative party in the United States. I'm not looking for a one party system.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's something good about having this healthy conversation with each other. So I guess by faith, I'm hoping and believing that we can get back to that, and that maybe there are some things that are happening now that will, like the way people are disappearing and some of the real radical things that are happening, that maybe some people will start to wake up. They'll wake up and they'll say, this isn't really what I was wanting to have happen.
Yeah. We can ask Jesus together, what would you have us conserve? And I think he'd have us conserve love for one another. I think he'd have us conserve the compassion and mercy of Jesus Christ, to conserve the golden rule and treat people as we'd want to be treated, even where we disagree. There's a lot to conserve that has very little to do with these modern movements, but, and then where would he like to see us experience liberty and growing kind of liberty that, it's for freedom that Christ has set us free, and that's not based in my self-will or my rights. It's based in knowing him. So back to the gospel. Maybe the gospel will help us. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Brad.
All right.
Thanks again, Brad. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Grace Saves All. You can help spread the word by sharing this podcast with others and by giving it a rating on iTunes. If you want to find out more about David, or if you'd like to leave him a message, go to his website, davidartman.net. In the meantime, let's work together to help a hurting world know about the greatest news ever announced.